We're doing our Parsha class, and the Parsha this week is Chayei Sarah. We'll dedicate our learning tonight. It was sponsored in memory of Netta Bat Baruch. Her neshama should have an aliyah. As usual, we'll quickly review the general story of the Parsha and then start looking at it with more depth. We begin the Parsha with the recording of Sarah's passing, and Avram has to come bury her. And he speaks to the Hittites, to the people of Chet, and they approve his burial of Sarah. He asks them to help him get the Maros HaMachpelah, and Ephron willingly agrees to sell for him. He charges a hefty price, which Avram is swift to pay. Avram then buries his wife, and Avram sees he needs a shidduch for his son. So Avram sends his trusted servant out to find a wife, and the servant goes out with camels laden with the goods of Avram's home. And when he comes to the well, he asks God, let me succeed in my way, and the girl who will succeed in doing the sign, she is the one that fits for my master's son. And the sign is, he will ask her to give him a drink, and she will say, I'll give you and your camels to drink. So he's just finished making this request of God, and a girl comes out, and he runs out to her. He asks her, could you give me something to drink? She gives him to drink, and she says, now I'll also give your camels. And she goes and gives the camels. And after all that, he gives her gifts and asks her, who are you? And she says, I'm the daughter of Bisua from Milcah. So he realizes she's a relative. That's exactly what Avram wanted, a relative from his family. And he blesses God for making him succeed. He asks her, is there room in your father's house for us to come with the camels? She says, yeah, sure, we have a place where people sometimes put up their camels. She runs back home, reports that this man has come and he wants a place in their home for his camels. And Lavan runs out to greet him. He hugs him, kisses him. Doesn't hug him and kiss him, I'm sorry. That we'll see in 2 weeks from now. Lavan comes out to greet him. Says, come on home, we've cleared the house for you, there's room for the camels. And then he tells him that he wants to bring Rivka back, and they agree. The next morning he says, let me go. They say, no. They say, no, that they have to ask Rivka, give her some time. He says, no, I gotta go. They say, we'll ask her. Rivka says, I'm gonna go, and Rivka goes. And as they're on their way back, they see Yitzchak going out to greet them. Yitzchak wasn't really going out to greet them, but that's what it looked like. And Yitzchak bumps into them, and the slave tells Yitzchak what a wonderful girl he's brought him. Yitzchak brings her home, and he loves her. And then Avram marries another wife, and he has more children. Avram passes away, and he's buried by Yitzchak and Yishmael in that Me'arat HaMachpelah. And then, at the end of the parasha, tells us the generations that Yishmael had, which will lead us into the continuation of Yitzchak's story. So now, let's review the parsha with more depth. My assumption is you guys learned Rashi. I hope I'm assuming correctly. So you gotta know Rashi, that's the basis. We ended last week's parsha. Avram was faced with quite possibly his most difficult test. We know Avram had 10 tests. And there's a machloket how we enumerate those 10 tests. You could look it up in the Mishnah, in Pirkei Avot. The commentaries right away bring you the different opinions. The Mishnah in the 5th chapter that records numbers, right? The 5th chapter is all about numbers. 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Avram. And one of the numbers in that Mishnah, in that chapter, is the 10 tests of Avram. One opinion says that Avram's top test, the apex of Avram's service of Hashem, was at the end of last week's parsha, when he was willing to take his son up that mountaintop and bind him. Another opinion says that no, this was a more difficult test. It was more difficult to contend with losing his wife and not having a place to bury her than binding his son. So on the surface, that's very hard to understand. Maybe we'll get back to it if we have time at the end of class. How could you say this was such a difficult test? Avram teaches us a lot from the way he does his business practices. Firstly, we see that even at the most emotional time of his life, he has just lost his wife, he's come back from succeeding at his test, succeeding at the binding, and God tells him, no, that's not what I wanted of you, you're great that you agreed to do it, but take this ram, to offer it instead, and go home with Yitzchak. And he thinks he's coming home, back home, and he's coming to a totally different home. He's lost his wife. There's a discussion when this happened exactly. The dates don't exactly work out. But the simple understanding is that she passed away just after that. And then think of where Avram was holding, the emotional turmoil. Going straight from the Akedah, one form of emotional turmoil, to burying his wife. And Avram lives among the Hittites. The customs in those days were the following. When a person died, you'd save their memory. So you'd make a carpet of the skin. You'd make a tapestry. Correct.
That's horrible.
They would have ways of mummifying, ways of preserving the person's body, different ways of ensuring that you remembered the person, or else they'd cremate, or else they'd bury. But no one believed that there was any point in honoring the body, because the body, that's it, you know? Like an animal dies, you eat it, so we don't eat it. We want to preserve the memory. Maybe we'll make a tapestry of the skin. You know, maybe we'll bury it so it decomposes and doesn't bring disease. But Avram is now forced to contend with another aspect of spreading monotheism, and that is that there's a future, there's a soul. The human being is not a more sophisticated animal. The human being is Selam Elokim, a representation of God, and there is a continuum. When a person dies, it's not all over. And that is the challenge that Avram faces here at the moment of this great emotional challenge of having lost his wife. Yeah, David.
Why do we need to preserve the body? He's burying the body. He's not leaving out for display in the museum. I mean, having the body preserved on the ground wouldn't any more preserve the memory than having him remember her.
Why did people do this, you're saying?
Yeah.
You'll notice that the Torah almost never discusses the pagan beliefs. The Torah tells us don't do it, and the Torah says sometimes it's not worth anything, and the Torah says sometimes it's not going to lead you anywhere, and it'll only lead you astray. But the Torah, as a matter of policy, does not invest much time explaining what's false. Because when you're focused on the truth, you don't have to spend time saying this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is why that's wrong. I'm not sure it's worth our time to explore why they did something that was wrong. This thought is not my own, it's Nachmanides points this out, as do other Rishonim. So, Sarah has lived a long life. She's lived 127 years. And she was blessed with beauty, as we know that at age 90 and 100 she's abducted for her beauty. So she has been blessed, and Chazal tell us that Sarah was one of the most beautiful women that ever lived. And now Avram is going to have to face life without her. Chazal tell us, "En ha'ish met ela le'ishto, v'en ha'isha meta ela le'ba'ala." When a husband passes away, the one that feels it most is the wife. It's as though he only died for her. That's why it says, "Vayamot Elimelech ish Naomi." Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, passed away. He was also the father of Machlon Nechilin. He was also a leader of the Jewish people. Yes, but no one feels it like the wife. And by the same token, when a wife passes away, no one feels it like a husband. It's as though they died specifically for them. That this event affected only them, because the magnitude in which it affects the spouse is on a totally different scale than anyone else. So Avram, in spite of all his feelings, Avram maintains balance. sometimes a person loses a relative and they go off the handle. Chazal tell us that that's prohibited. Person, by going off the handle, they say, I am more merciful than God. So that's why the Torah gives us an order. There's Shiva, 7 days of mourning, there are 30 days. And then, a person will sometimes scratch himself, cause himself to bleed, a person will sometimes pull out hair, a person will sometimes spend a year where they're not willing to be comforted. Chazal say, once a person goes beyond the limits the Torah gave us, then God says, be careful, because I'll give you something else to weep about. And the Torah writes about Avram's weeping with a small kaf. Avram came to weep Sarah as harshly as he felt it, for Sarah was his wife, and he, more than anyone else, knew to appreciate the greatness of Sarah. Nonetheless, he knew that she was blessed. She had 127 years. And he maintained perspective, even in this difficult time. V'livkota, his weeping for her is written with a small kaf, to remind us that Avram knew to appreciate that she did live a long life. She did live till 127. She should have lived longer. She died early because she said to Avram, let God judge between us. And whenever one says that, God judges the person who said that first. And that's why Sarah died earlier. But at the end of the day, she did live till 127. And Avram maintains his focus. He goes to the people of Chet and says to them, look, I am a ger. I'm a sojourner. I don't yet have citizenship around here. But I'm also a toshav. I do want to have citizenship here. Because I wasn't born into this country, I don't have an inheritance, a piece of land where I could bury someone who passed away. On the other hand, because I want to remain here and become a citizen, I would like you to grant me a piece of land, but I want it to be a burial plot that will remain for the family, an area that will be an achuzat kaver, a place of permanence for burial. And Avram is presenting them with one of the basics of Jewish faith, and that is that a human being is not a more sophisticated animal, but rather a human being has a neshama. We have a soul, we have something godly about us. God created us, b'tzelem Elokim. As the Rambam writes, the human being is not a non-kosher animal. It's not that we say, don't eat humans because they don't have split hoofs and they don't chew their cud. Incorrect, says the Rambam. We are not part of the animal kingdom. The reason we don't eat humans is not because, well, you have kosher animals and non-kosher animals, and according to the criterion that the Torah delineates, well, I guess we're a non-kosher animal. Incorrect. We are not an animal. We are on a different plane. We are human beings. And when a person dies, part of our responsibility is to indicate that something happened here. If we're walking around town and a newcomer walks in, he's a drunk. And the guy is a slob and the guy is filthy and the guy talks filthy and the guy is the worst person you could think of and he's a thief and he's caught pickpocketing and everything filthy you could think about him he does. And then the next morning he drops dead. We bury him. Let's say the guy says, my name is Shimon Chaim. And then he wants an aliyah. So we might not give him an aliyah. But we see he's Jewish. And then he dies. We look around. There's no family. We have a special mitzvah to bury him. Even a Kohen Gadol would have to defile himself if there was no one else around to bury him. The value of human life. Even a human being who has not been using life to the fullest, to say the least. The Kohen Gadol must take out his time and the whole Jewish people is going to suffer because he's not going to be there to do the service. He has to bury him. And the court appoints people who sit Shiva over this person. And people come and comfort them. Because something happened here. This isn't a horse that dropped dead. This is a human being that dropped dead. And part of what Avram is teaching the people of Chet is the value of human life. And one of the ways we indicate the value of human life is through the procession we make when a person passes away. The honor we give the deceased. Avram comes to eulogize Sarah, to speak about her greatness and to weep over Sarah. And the people of Chet tell Avram, sir, we admire your humility, but you are not a sojourner in our land. You're like a king. What do you mean? You're a man of God. You choose where you want to bury her, bury her. Why leave the body out like this? No one's going to withhold their burial from you. And Avram says, I appreciate it. He bows before them and he says, fine, if you guys really want me to bury this body quickly, well then, listen, help me out and speak to Ephron he should give me the cave that's at the edge of his field, and I'll pay him full price right away when all you guys are present. I'm not asking to have tashlumim to pay him over time. I want to pay him now, but I want it as an achuzat kavim. I'm not just taking a kever like you guys said, a place to bury. No, I'm taking an achuzat kavim. This is going to be a permanent place for burial for my family. Now, Avram was asking for something which was really unusual. In those days, even in the times of kings, people didn't easily give away their familial territory. Families had land, and it was considered a matter of honor that you never gave it away. When the Israeli king Ahav wanted to purchase a piece of land that was next to his own, and he went to Novos, and he said, Novos, let me buy the vineyard that's next to my territory. I'll give you better territory. I'll give you great land. I'll give you a great price for it. What does Novos say? He says, God forbid. That's in my family. That's my family's plot of land. I would never sell that. Novos HaYisraeli. In the end of Melachim Aleph, in Kings 1, towards the end, Novos refuses Ahav. And Ahav goes home in a fury, and his wife figures out a way of framing Novos and having him executed by a fool's court. But Ahav could not take Novos' territory by force. Why not? Because if Ahav would walk in and take that territory by force, he'd have a rebellion on his hands. The most cherished thing that people had in those days was the piece of land that was their familial territory. This was their land that was their family's plot. You didn't sell that unless you really, really had no choice. And Avram is making a request that we think, oh, he's just asking for a cave. No, Avram is making for a request that comes with a hefty price. He's saying, I want that to remain mine. I want to turn that into a burial plot, and I want you to ask Ephron to do that for me. Ephron agrees, but we have to understand that Avram made a big request. Chazal tell us that the picture is a little bit the other way. Chazal tell us that the cave used to have haunted sounds coming out of it. No one wanted to go near that cave. God made it so that no one would walk in there and see Adam and Eve buried. The cave, Avram stumbled upon the cave when three angels came to visit him after his bris milah, and he went to bring a calf, so the calf ran away. And even though he had just been circumcised and wasn't so easy for him to walk, he waddled after the calf, and then it moved some more, and then he waddled some more, and then he moved some more, until finally the calf led him to the cave. And he comes upon this cave, and he smells the Garden of Eden. Everyone else would hear voices and sounds, and everyone else was scared of even going into that field. But Avram smells the Garden of Eden, and he walks in, and he sees lit candles, and he sees Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, and he sees the shine of Adam, Adam created by God's hands. And Avram said, this is where I want to be buried with my wife. Think about it. Avram could have just said, let the calf go, I'll make them two calves. He, in spite of all his pain, he chased after that calf so that he'll have three calves to give the angels. And it paid off. He discovered Maris HaMachpelah. Ephron, Chazal tell us, was a mean fellow. What we said initially is pshat. Chazal tell us the Medrash that Ephron knew this field was a worthless field, rocky field that no one wanted, and everyone was scared of the voices you'd hear from that cave. And nonetheless, Ephron took top dollar for the field. But that's the Medrash. Remember, Torah has levels. Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod. On the level of Medrash, that's the tradition we have. On the level of pshat, we have to understand that Ephron was forgoing a hefty piece of territory, and Avram was making it blatantly clear he was changing the zoning laws. He wanted to change this into a burial plot. Ephron was amongst the leaders, and Chazal tell us that day he was appointed amongst the leaders, and the reason was that God wanted Avram to deal with top people. God wanted Avram to be purchasing from a governor. He shouldn't have to buy his land from a simpleton. So God made Ephron rise in power for the occasion. And Ephron tells Avram, where everyone could hear, he says, no, listen, the the field is all yours, and the cave, I've given it to you. Everyone sees I've given it to you. You just bury your dead. Let's be quick with burying the dead. Ephron's a politician. When you talk to a politician, you have to hear what they're saying, and then you have to hear what they're saying. So Ephron says, where everyone sees, I've given it to you. What's Ephron saying? Out here, I can't talk to you. Everyone's looking. Don't worry, you and I will square off when no one's looking, and then we'll settle the price. Avram understands the hint. He bows in front of all the leaders. He indicates to them, thank you so much. It's only thanks to you that I actually got this deal. He shows his appreciation, and he says to Ephron, I appreciate it, Mr. Ephron, but I have a condition. I will not bury my dead till I've paid for the plot. Everyone here is trying to rush him to bury her, then make the deal. You will find often in life that people try to rush you to their conditions, and there's a certain sense of goodwill. Don't worry, it'll be okay. Right? Just sign over here. It's a good credit card, I'm telling you. Come on, you know how many benefits you have? Whenever people encourage you, remember Avram. He had Sarah's body rotting. We have a halacha that says that when a woman passes away, the quicker you are to bury her, the more honor you're giving her. Because a woman's body, every person's body when they die starts decomposing and the fluids start coming out. Women have more fluids that can come out. Their body gets more disgraced as they're sitting there and rotting. So we have a halacha. Out of respect for women, we bury them as quick as we can. We don't leave the body to decompose or anything. We try to bury every person quickly. But we're quicker with a woman than a man out of respect for them. Avram knows all this. But Avram also knows that if you want to have a good deal, you figure out the fine print before you make a move. They're telling him, don't worry, bury her, we'll work it out later. You know, it's like you're coming to sign a contract and you ask the landlord, are the mezuzahs kosher? He says, I think they're kosher. If not, we'll work it out later. Are you going to fix that broken closet? Sure, don't worry about it. Let's just sign the contract. What about the front door? You know, everything, don't worry, whatever you want. Go call him up a week later. And there's always that feeling, oh, he's a good person, why not? If it ain't written, and if he didn't do it, then you're at his mercy. And that's what Avram knows. They're all pressuring him, bury her, we'll work it out. And Avram says, no. I am not burying her till we've worked it out and I have paid for the territory. And he basically tells the Hittites, I'm not doing it till we close the deal. I'm not going to bury her and afterwards work out the details of the deal. And this is a very important rule. Imagine had Avram buried her first. Then there's room for all the misunderstandings in the world. I meant this much of the field or that much of the field. I meant I'd give it to you for free for a week. I meant I'd give it to you for free for a generation. Baruch haba. We have to learn from Avram. This wasn't an easy time for him. More than they wanted to see her buried, he wanted to see her buried. He wasn't happy leaving her body out while he's having all these deliberations, but he didn't let that pressure push him into a bad move. He deals with them respectfully, he deals with them fairly, and he's going to pay them top dollar. But he's also going to make the deal in a way that they're not going to be able to say later, well, we didn't know. And that's why he declares in front of the Hittites and he tells Ephron, he says, and you should know it is going to be a burial place for my family for eternity. It is an achuzat kever. And when Ephron says, no problem, take it, everyone's witness, I'm giving it to you, Avram says, I appreciate it, I'll take it, on condition that we close the deal before I bury her. Ephron says, bury the body already. You know, everyone's always very pious when they try to push you into a deal. It's your interest, you know. We went to buy a shrogim. You guys remember? So the guy says, would I lie to you? You remember what I answered him? I said, you want to lend me 100 shekel? He says, what do you mean? I said, would I lie to you? The seller is always saying, come on. Especially here in Israel, you know. They work on your conscience. We're all family. Guys, don't buy into it. No such thing. Avram has his wife rotting there. And Avram will not move forward until the details of the deal are closed. What? The guy smiled. He said, what does $100 have to do with the esrog? I said, do you want me to believe you about the esrog? So I want you to believe me about 100 shekel. You won't, right? So to me, the mitzvah was worth like 100 shekel. He says, but I never met you. I said, oh, right. And I never met you either, right? You remember that, right? Brett, you were there.
Probably more important than to get a good deal and to bury Sarah quickly.
Because he didn't want Sarah's bones plowed upon. He knew that unless the deal is closed, that this is his for eternity, and he is buying it with the pre-stipulation that it will be a burial plot, Ephron could wake up one day and say, well, I need that area when I plow my field. It's in my way. I gave it to you, but for a period. The Hittites weren't beyond that. They weren't above that. He knew that if things aren't clearly written, and this was a deed that was passed down to Yaakov Avinu, to Yosef, the Jews had the deed. It was very important to them. Until we conquered the land of Israel, they had the deed, and that right ensured that their bodies weren't harmed. But he knew that if he doesn't have it etched in stone, so to speak, they could very easily change the conditions of the deal. And remember, he was also changing zoning laws. They had an area where they buried their dead. Ephron was coming and saying, I want to bury here. They said, sure. He said, okay, fine, let's write it down. They said, don't bury her, don't worry about it. He said, no.
What did they write it down on?
It seems like parchment. It seems like it was parchment. But I don't remember that it explicitly says it elsewhere. It seems it was parchment. But I'm not... just because that was a standard practice then. But I don't remember of a source that says it explicitly.
Would the cave be safe? If he buys it, it's still in their territory. What's stopping them is...
So he... Ephron tells him, don't worry, I'll give you the field too. Why should a man like you have to go through someone else's field to go and bury your dead? Who are we kidding? Ephron knew he had a worthless field, and Ephron wanted to make good money on the sale. So Ephron ups the price and tells him, no, it's only 400 silver coins. Who cares? 400 silver coins, Ephron heard the number very clearly. He understood. He was taking territory that in our day and age was worth... $50,000 and was telling him $2 million worth of property. What's that between me and you? What you worried about? Avram says, no problem. On the spot, he says, I don't need credit. I'm paying you now. Where everyone sees, and he pays him. And he pays him the best coins, meaning that coins that could be used here or there. He took the top weight, and he took the top form of coin, and he paid him. And after he's finished the sale, then Avram goes and buries Sarah. And Avram now is left alone. Chazal tell us it's never good to be alone. Avram should look for a wife for himself. But Avram has a son. How old is Yitzhak at this point? 40.
37.
40. Avram... It's 37, 40, and Hashem has a way that Hashem runs the world. The verse says in Ecclesiastes, "V'zarach Hashemesh uva Hashemesh." The sun sets, the sun rises. Before God sets one sun, God starts rising another sun. We have a rule that before one great person passes away, God sets up another person to fill his shoes. God never leaves the world without the sun's, so to speak, the luminaries that will light up the world. And so the Torah records at the end of last week's parsha that Rivka was already born before Sarah passed away. And this was the future Sarah. This was the one that was going to fill her shoes. Chazal tells that one of the things a person should do is take care of his son to get married. His sons, his daughter, and not wait till they're too old. Avram, before he's going to look for his own wife, is going to ensure that Yitzchak is married. Avram was also, he had a close encounter with death. He almost lost Yitzchak. And so, after the Akedah, Avram starts thinking, wait a second, we got to work on Yitzchak's future. Avram is going to send for his own family. Why does he send for his own family? So certain things run in families and certain things don't. Diseases can run in families. If there's a family that two people had a certain disease, you have to worry that that family might have that disease. If there are two hemophiliacs in a family, so we're concerned. We today we could check it, but in the time of Chazal, we'd be careful. We wouldn't circumcise the kid. We'd be careful. We'd be careful whether we want to marry into the family. So there are certain things that run in families. Health issues run in families. And certain health issues run in families. And also traits run in families. You could have people of different religions in the same family, meaning people could have different beliefs, but usually the traits of a family are very alike. That's why when we look for a school, we have to try and look for a school for our children where they'll teach them to be a God-fearing person, they'll teach them how to serve Hashem. We also would prefer a school where they have good traits, but we have to know that more than the school impacts the traits, the home impacts the traits. We definitely look for good friends for our kids and we look for good traits, but we have to know that all things considered, if you have a good home, you have a good wife, and you're bringing up a good home, your house should have a considerable impact on your kids. Today, we live in a day and age where that has changed because parents aren't home. You know, the kid comes home and he has a nanny. The kid comes home and he has a TV. By the time the parents come home, they're putting him to sleep. So today, it's a bit of a problem. But if you run a traditional style home where the wife is home and she's and the kid's coming home to the parents and the parents are there and the kid grows up with his parents and he's only spending a small number of hours considering in school, then the parents should have a much greater impact on what type of person the child is, what traits he has. I'm saying again, today it's changed because parents aren't bringing up their kids. They look at the school as though they're supposed to do everything. But that's a mistake. That's shunning responsibility. Our responsibility is to bring up our kids. And so Avram knows that all the people around him in Canaan, they're pagans. But it's not only that they're pagans, they're not as kind as he'd like them to be. So Avram wants a girl for his son Yitzchak, a girl that will have the traits of his family, the traits of kindness. And that's why Avram is going to send an emissary out to his family back in Aram Naharaim to try and get a wife for his son. And you'll notice that Eliezer never discusses with her which pagan god does she believe in. You'll notice that this isn't one of the criterion that Avram sets Eliezer up with. He tells him, bring me a girl from my family. Bring me a girl who's going to go the way of this house. Because when it comes to beliefs, we could talk. And after we talk, you're an intelligent person, so you'll understand what's right and what's wrong. So you grew up thinking you should serve Zeus. I'll explain to you why Zeus is nonsense. You grew up believing all kinds of pagan beliefs. Fine. That can a person can outgrow far more easily than the traits that he grew up with. The way he looks at his fellow man. Are we all predators? Is it a dog-eat-dog world? Or are we all human beings that are here to help one another, to build a better world? The attitudes we have in life and the attitudes we have to our fellow man, those are things that are or should be defined by the homes we grew up in. And Avram knows that in his home, that's one thing they did do right. And that's why Avram wants a girl who's going to do that right. When I started dating, so I asked Rav Pesin Zatzal, I asked him, what should I look for in a girl? So he said to me, well, the Mishnah says, what's the best trait? A good heart. A good heart encompasses everything. That's what you look for, a good heart.
But wasn't Lavan, wasn't he dodgy?
Wasn't he what?
Dodgy, no, he was a devious.
No one said he was a good, he was a fair businessman. He was not a fair businessman. But he does take his nephew in. And we see they have a special place in their house that when Lavan's sister meets a stranger and he asks her, is there room for me to come? This girl of 3 years old is confident, yes, I'm going to go home and verify it with my parents. But yes, we have a place that's set aside for guests. She knows what kind of home her parents run. Avram was an old man. God had blessed him with everything. One opinion is he had Yitzchak. One opinion is he had a daughter. One opinion is that in those days and ages when you couldn't find a good shidduch for a girl and he'd have real problems with her, so God blessed him that he didn't have a daughter, because it would have just given him heartache. He wouldn't have found a good shidduch for her. So God blessed him with everything, and Avram calls his servant, the elder of his house, who was really in charge of everything. Because Avram's so old that he's concerned, maybe he's going to die. Chazal tell us when someone from the group dies, everyone from the group has to be worried. Avram just lost his companion for life, his niece, his wife, right, Sarah. And so Avram says, I don't know how much longer I have left to live. And so Avram calls in his servant Eliezer, and you'll notice that Eliezer, by name, his name only shows up once in the Torah, but we have on tradition that this servant was Eliezer. And he tells him, do me a favor, I want you to promise me that you will not take a wife or my daughter from the Canaanite girls. Why is this servant getting Yitzchak a wife? Why isn't Yitzchak going himself? Chazal tell us that if a Talmud Chacham goes to get married, he should take along an Amoretz. So Chazal say, if a sage goes to get married, he should take along a simple person with him. Why? Because a person whose head is in spirituality and high up there will not always be keen on finding out all the simple things. Eliezer is an amazing shadchan, as we'll see in a minute. And the person who is very spiritual is not always going to be capable of finding the right girl and setting up the deal properly. So Avram knows Yitzchak is holy. Yitzchak is amazing. But when I need a shidduch for Yitzchak, I need someone who knows how to wheel and deal. Someone who's going to know how to check out the girls. And we're going to see that Eliezer does. So he calls in Eliezer and he says, I don't know when I'm going, I'm an old man, but I need you to promise me, and I warn you, I'm threatening you with the God of the heaven and the earth. If you go against what I say, I will take care of you in heaven and in earth. You have to promise me that you find my son a wife, not a girl from the Canaanite girls. Eliezer is a little bit bothered by this, because he himself is a Kanani and he has a daughter. And all these years he's been learning by Avram, he's been hoping that Avram will take his daughter for for Avram's son, for Yitzchak. And Avram tells Eliezer, he says, look, you're Kanani. You became a ger, you learned Torah, but at the end of the day, you've been cursed. And the cursed one doesn't bond well with the blessed one. I come from Shem, who was blessed. You come from Canaan, who was cursed. Notice what Avram told him. The cursed one does not bond well with the blessed one. The blessed one can bond well with the cursed one. But the cursed one won't bond well with the blessed one. The one who's on top very often is willing to be benevolent. He's willing to connect. But the one who's on bottom has no appreciation for what it means to be holy. The one who's on bottom is not going to connect. He says, you know, I know my son Yitzchak. Yitzchak will love your daughter. Yitzchak will be a good husband and he'll do his best to build the house the way it should with your daughter. But your daughter isn't going to live up to her end of the deal. She's incapable of connecting with him. Very often we think we're doing someone a favor when we take 10 steps down. Someone once told me, if my job was to marry this girl and that'll be my job in life, so be it. I don't know, I can't speak on behalf of God, but I'm not sure that's what God wants us to do. That'll be his kindness, he'll spend his whole life being kind to this girl? I don't know, I don't think that'll work. Yeah? Okay, so Eliezer says, but you know, a girl grows up in one place, she might not want to come here. And should I get him the right wife, even if it means that he'll have to move there? You know, what, you come to a girl, you know, people do that all the time. I'm going to be living here. And the girl doesn't always agree to go live there. So I believe that location shouldn't be a reason to break a shidduch. But unfortunately, many people disagree with me. So Avram tells him, no, my son is not going back there. God took me out of there, and he promised me I'm having this land. So in fulfillment of his promise, he should send his angel with you, and you should succeed in bringing the wife here. And if the woman doesn't agree, so then you don't bring my son there. So then you won't have to marry him off there. Avram tells him, if she doesn't agree, you will be clean of this vow. Meaning you won't have to take a girl from my family, but you still shouldn't take a girl from the Canaanite girls. We see here Avram's willingness to compromise. Avram says, initially we will shoot for what's exactly right. And if you see that doesn't work, so then we cannot compromise on Yitzchak leaving Israel. God told me we have to be here. Then we'll have to compromise on it being my family. You'll look for girls from Aner, Eshkol, Mamre, from Shem's descendants, but living here in Canaan. But Canaanite girls not. So sometimes we have to compromise on one thing. We have to know what we could and what we will and won't compromise. According to one understanding, Avram tells him, and if not, then it's not our job anymore. We did our best. God has to find the Meshiddah. And according to that understanding, Avram was saying, I'm responsible to marry off my son up to a point. After that, it's between him and God. People sometimes think they have to marry off their kids. You have to do your best. We help our kids as much as we can. At the end of the day, it's their responsibility. One understanding is that Avram says, don't you dare marry him off to my partners, Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre. And according to that understanding, we learn that sometimes people could be your business partners, you can make a pact with them, you could go to war with them, and they could risk their lives for you, and you'll risk their lives for them. But that still doesn't mean that your son should marry their daughter. That still doesn't mean that you fit, you match for marriage. Avram sends the servant, he takes 10 camels, and he takes some of his master's best wares, and he comes to the city. And here we start seeing Eliezer's wisdom. Eliezer waits outside the city. He says, you know, a girl behaves one way where everyone sees her, and she behaves a different way when she thinks no one sees her. If the girls go out to draw water at the well, I'm going to be out there, where they're laughing and giggling and behaving the way they behave without their parents looking over their shoulder and saying, nope, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. Eliezer comes to the well and he prays to God. And he says, I want a sign. Help me out, God. I'm going to ask the girl for water and she should offer me to water my camels as well. This is something that we should all aspire to this level of kindness. There's the kindness that says, this is what he asked for, this is what I'm giving him. And then there's the kindness that is indicative of being of Avram's family, and that is the kindness of thinking, what can I do beyond that? What can I do more that the person needs? And whenever we do kindness to a person, we could ask ourselves, why does he deserve it? This man came from Canaan. He has donkeys laden with goods, and this little girl is coming out, and he asks her, can I have a drink? So you think she'd say, mister, there's the well. Right? No. She says, sure. What's she thinking? He must be tired. He came from a long journey. She looks at the camels. You know how much water a camel drinks after a journey? She could say, mister, after you've rested, this is the well we draw for the camels for. These are the troughs. No. She says, I'll water them. You think after she's drawn 5 buckets, 10 buckets, she'd get tired and say, mister, you know, I really got to get home. They're waiting for me at home. I can't detain myself much longer. it is normal to expect that you have this big burly guy. I mean, he's the top servant. He's going to water his own camels at some point. No. Rivka continues watering them. Now, Rivka could think to herself, you know, this guy's a brute. I could help him. But why is he sitting on the sidelines watching? Va'ish mishta'ela. He's standing on the sidelines looking. You're doing a good job, girl.
She's 3 years old, right?
She's 3 years old. Okay, so she might have been built big. She must have been strong. She must have been... You could go with the medrash that she was 12. However you want, at the end of the day, 12, 15, I don't care. But you and I, if we came by, you know, there's a guy who just moved, right? The movers are standing at the side of the truck and they say, hey, could you get me a drink? We say, sure, we'll get you a drink. Could you help me unload these beds? And then they sit on the side and say, you're doing a good job, you know? I don't think we continue. Rivka is drawing and drawing and drawing. Va'ish mishta'ela. He's watching. Macharish, he's silent. He doesn't say, let me give you a hand. No, he's silent. This is a test. He wants to see, is she Avram's family? Is she going to stop and say, you know, till here? Or is she going to keep at it? And not only does she keep at it, she keeps at it swiftly. She's quick. She shows him respect, honor. And you know, there are two ways you could help someone. It is the morning after Shavuos. You've been up all night learning. You come home and you have your meal and you're ready to hit the sack. You've been falling asleep all through Kriyas HaTorah Shavuos morning. You guys know what that's like, right? So you barely make it through the meal. You put down the fork, you start benching, you lose your place about four times as you doze off through benching. And you're really thankful that you could go to bed. You put away the food. Just as you put away the food, there's a knock on the door. You open the door and there's this bright-eyed, cheery fellow who slept all night. And he says, I'm sorry, I overslept. I missed the meal at Machon Meir. Could you please, do you have maybe some extra challah or something? What does it mean to be a grandson of Avraham Avinu? It means to say, just a second, come on in, we'll get the challah, run to the fridge, and treat him as though he's the most important person on the planet. That's what Rivka just did. Here she sees this truck driver. I mean, he's built like a Mack truck. Eliezer, according to Chazal, according to one opinion, he was a top servant in Paro's house. He was given as a gift. Eliezer is a top warrior. He's equal 318 warriors. But he asked her, could you give me a drink? And she's watering his camels away. And swiftly, she's quick at it. When he sees that, he knows this is the girl. She was good looking. She was also from the family. And when he sees all of this, he sees that this is the girl. And he was lucky. Because maybe she was blind in one eye. Maybe she was an illegitimate child. He didn't know. And he ran quickly and gave her all the gifts and then said, what family are you from? And she says, I'm from Besuel. And then he knows he did it right. And then he gives thanks to Hashem. But he was quick to give her the gifts. And he doesn't tell that to anyone. You'll notice that he switches the story when he recounts it later. When he tells it to Lavan and Besuel, he says, after she passed the test, then I asked her, what family are you from? And she told me, and after she told me, I gave her all the gifts. That's not how it happened. But Eliezer asked God for a sign, and God gave him the sign. He asked her, do you have in your father's home a place for guests? And she's a place where I could put up my camels. She says, sure, we also have the food for the camels and place for you and your men to rest. And she goes back home. And she tells them that this man has come. Lavan hears that a wealthy man has come to town. So Lavan says, let's go see. I heard there's a limousine out there. So he's running out. He thought, you know, if he's given all these great gifts out, I see my sister comes home with all this gold. So he runs out and he tells him, come on in. Now, Who was Bethuel? Father of Rivka. Bethuel was not a very nice name. He was the top priest of the town, and he instituted a custom that any virgin that got married would have to spend the night before the wedding with him. That's why he was known as Bethuel. Bethulim are the hymen, and Bethuel, he had the power over everyone. So the people of the town hear that he's about to marry off his daughter. So they're knocking on his door. And they say, Mr. Bethuel, the rule in this town is that no one marries a virgin. So we're going to hold you to that rule. Bethuel says, not so fast. We got a year before she gets married. I hear you. You're right. That's the rule. We'll take care of it. But there's a year, you know. It's not happening tomorrow. And Bethuel and Lavan see all the wealth that Eliezer has come with. So they put poison in his soup and they figure, we're going to make it rich. God sends a malach down, switches the plates of soup, and at the end of the meal, Bethuel croaks and he's dead. Why does Rivka have to lose her father when she's going to marry Yitzchak? Because Rivka has to come to Yitzchak, a pure virgin. And had Bethuel been around, that wouldn't have happened. Her own father. So Rivka loses her father. And the next morning, Eliezer says, you know, we got to go. And Lavan and her mother say, what do you mean? Today? Things are good. We're all for it. But let the girl get ready. You know, we got to prepare a dowry. And this is where Eliezer plays it dumb. When you want to be a good businessman, sometimes you got to play it smart and sometimes you got to play it dumb. So he says, look, I don't know. Things are just right. You agree. I agree. I can't be detained. Yes or no? He said, what do you mean? She's a girl. She needs time. I don't know about time. I don't know. It works. It's fine. Let's go. Sometimes you got to be stupid in life. Believe me. Sometimes you just got to be stupid. They'll give you all kinds of details. And you just got to repeat the same line. I don't know. It works. We got to go. You'll notice he does that. You'll see that in Tanakh other times as well. You want to get the deal? Sometimes just stick to your guns. Sometimes you don't even have to change your claim. If someone makes a claim, and you accept the claim, so then you have to figure out a new claim. If you just say the same claim a second time, they start feeling stupid to say the same answer a second time. Now, if someone's going to play that game with you, you have to be stupid. You have to answer the same answer. You say, look, I don't think it's fair. He says, no, I think it's fair because A, B, C, D, and E. You say, I don't think it's fair. Now, what are you telling him? I mean, the underlying message is your first answer wasn't a good answer. You don't say that. In his mind, he has to figure out another answer because it's not nice to say the same answer again. If he's smart, if you're on the other end of the deal, what you should say is the same answer you said the first time. Because if you believe that your first answer had legitimacy, you don't have to change the answer. Eliezer's playing it dumb. We gotta go. But the girl is there. We gotta go. Okay, we'll ask the girl. If you stick to your guns, the other side always feels like they got to come up with a new claim because you obviously didn't accept their counter-argument. But if anyone does that to you guys, you outsmart them. You just say the same answer again. And then they might tell you, well, I see we're staying in the same place in this negotiation. And the answer, I guess we are. You don't have to be pushed. I mean, if they're not budging, you're not budging. You don't always have to be Mr. Polite. It says that the Torah is supposed to teach us everything. Also how to be good businessmen. So okay, so we got to learn some of that too. I mean, this is a story about transactions. Avram's transactions and Eliezer's transactions. And they call over Rivka. Now, if you think about it, Eliezer lost nothing by taking this risk. What's the worst case scenario? He'll be back where he started off. They're taking a risk. Eliezer said, we got to go. They said no. Eliezer said, we got to go. They said, we'll ask the girl. What's the worst thing that'll happen? He'll be back where he started off. Right? But that doesn't happen. Rivka says, of course I'll go. And they bless her. And from there we have the custom that when a couple gets married, they get blessed. The ancient custom used to be that the badekin was done without the chasm being there. And the rabbis would bless the kala. That was the procession of the badekin. The rabbis would give her a blessing as she went off to her chasm to get married. Today the Yekis still have this custom that the parents bless the kala on the chuppah, on her throne. Before she goes to the chuppah, she gets a blessing. Her father places his hands on her head, and her future father-in-law, he's not allowed to touch her, he places his hands above her head, and he blesses her, Yisimech Elokim, Kesalah, Rivka, Rachel, Bela, etc. Just like we do Friday night. They bless her and they say, At Hayi, your kindness should find favor in your husband's eyes, and he should never marry another wife, and you should multiply to hundreds of thousands to millions, and your offspring should inherit, just as God blessed Avram's seed. And Eliezer and Rivka head out. Rivka goes behind him. From here we learn derech eretz, that a man doesn't walk behind a woman. Rather, he tries to walk in front of a woman, because if the woman is behind, nothing wrong is going to happen by her seeing him walk ahead. If he's behind, then his eyes might go wandering at her figure walking ahead of him. So out of respect to her, the man walks in the front so that he shouldn't be staring at her as she's walking. But that doesn't mean he doesn't hold the door for her. Now, there's a problem. We have this old servant and the girl alone traveling back to Canaan. Yitzchak wants to daven about his shidduch. It's a good idea to daven about his shidduch. Till you're married, you should be davening about your shidduch. Not till engagement, till you're married. And the day after you're married, you should start davening about your marriage. There are things in life that need siyata dishmaya. They need heavenly help. One of them is finding a good wife. One of them is maintaining a good marriage. As skilled as all of you guys probably are, and as good a husband as you'll be, you still need siyata dishmaya to have a good marriage. So until your marriage, you pray to find a good wife. And from the first day of marriage onward, you pray that the marriage will succeed. Yitzchak is going out to daven, and he goes to the place where Hagar had prayed and had the vision. The angel had appeared to her, and he doesn't know it, but terem yikruv ani ene, the way God deals with the righteous is that before they even ask, God is already doing what they want. So he's going out to pray, and Rivka's already en route on her way back to Israel. And Yitzchak has traveled to Be'er Lachai Ro'i, to the place where the angel had appeared, and he went there to pray. And after he finished his prayer there, he was on his way back, and he felt he needed to pray again. When you have really meaningful prayer, so then it's hard to depart. It's like you've met with a good friend. You want to know when you've met your wife? A good sign is when, at the end of the date, you don't want to go home. You feel like, I want to go back. I want to continue talking. When you miss her, when you think, gee, I wish I could share with her what's happening now. That's a good indicator that you've met someone you like talking to, someone who you're going to enjoy talking to. I'm not saying that's the only indicator. But that's the type of relationship we're supposed to have with Hashem. That's the type of relationship we're supposed to have when we daven. It's not a toil, but rather, I've had an opportunity to share with Hashem what's closest to my heart, what's been bothering me most. And when I walk out of that conversation, I feel bad, and I feel like, when can I get back into conversation with Hashem? So Yitzchak has been coming, Mibe'er Lachai Ro'i, he had finished his focus of prayer, he went to the Kotel, and he davened, and he poured his heart out. Kotel, I mean figuratively. He went to Be'er Lachai Ro'i, which was their Kotel then. And then when he leaves, it's like you're walking up the Jewish quarter, and you see the Ramban's shul, and you say, wait, I have a few more words, I still want to talk to God. And he takes a detour. So, Vayitzei Yitzchak Lasuach Basadeh, he goes off the beaten path, he goes back into the field where he won't meet up with anyone, and he wants to start talking to God again. It's turning afternoon, it's turning night, and he composes the Mincha prayer. He goes out to talk to Hashem again.
Why didn't he go to Kivmachari, where his mother was? I
would have to guess. I have a guess, but your guess is as good as mine. I don't know of any source that addresses that. Meaning, this needs a separate discussion. Why did he really go to Be'er Lachai Ro'i? Why was he going there? According to one understanding in Chazal, he was going to bring his father a wife. His father was busy getting him a wife, and he was busy going to get his father a wife. Each one was taking care of the other. So he's going off into the field where he assumes he will not be bothered. No one's going to talk to him. He's off the beaten path to pray. And as he's walking into the field to pray, he sees camels coming towards him. And he sees unusual camels. They're muzzled. The only person who's so careful about putting a muzzle on their camel it shouldn't eat from anyone else's field is Avram. And so they're headed towards him. And Rivka looks out and she sees a young man and it looks like he's coming towards them. So Eliezer figures, okay, God gave him prophecy, he knows to come and greet us. Yitzhak, no such thing, he was going out there to pray. God saw to it that it worked out right. Rivka says, who's that man? Eliezer says, that's my master. So Rivka covers herself, and from there we have the custom that the kala gets covered for the wedding, right? The kala has a veil in front of her at the wedding. One understanding in Chazal is that she literally fell off the camel, and when she fell off the camel, she wounded herself, and she was no longer a virgin. And a deer came along and covered it up, and then when they came home and Yitzhak was going to marry her, Avram said to him, I don't trust Eliezer. You verify that nothing happened en route from there to here. And when Yitzhak tries to verify, he comes back and says, Eliezer, what's wrong? She's not the pure girl that I should have gotten. And Eliezer says, I swear, I did nothing. Come, I'll show you where she fell off the camel and you'll see. And they go back there and they uncover and they see that really that's what happened there. And because Eliezer was mistrusted unfairly, Eliezer is one of the righteous people that entered the Garden of Eden without dying. Eliezer is one of the righteous people in Jewish history. Yitzchak brings her into his tent and he loves her. And from here we learn that sometimes love develops only from within the tent. Only after the couple has been intimate. People often think that you have to love the person way in advance. No, sometimes you have everything that it takes to love the person, and it develops into that. Love is very difficult to find when you're dating, and you're shomer negiya, and you're not going to see one another for 3 years before you get married. You're just going to verify that you match, so then you could see that you guys match, you're compatible, that you have a good relationship, that you want to be with this person. But true love really develops with time. And only after he marries Rivka is he comforted over his mother. Chazal tell us the nature of a person is they're connected to their mother until they get married, and after they're married, their faithfulness goes to their wives. And if it isn't that way, guys, you got a problem. So work on it. No, that's the norm. Even when a parent is alive, your faithfulness is to your wife, and even if it doesn't come naturally, then work on it. Work on it externally. Avram marries Keturah, which Chazal tell us was Hagar, that she was especially righteous Hagar. All those years she waited for Avram, and she merited to have great nations. The Midianites came from her. The Ashurim, Letushim, Leumim, many nations came from Avram. And from here we learn that a person should never remain single. Avram was an old man. Think about it. He was 128. How old was he? 131. And he could have said, you know, how many years do I have left to live? He had decades left to live. But Chazal tell us, if you brought children to the world in your youth, bring children to the world when you're older. A person never knows which will succeed. Rabbi Kiva Eger's first wife couldn't have kids. For years, he was married to her, and they didn't have any kids. And then she passed away, and it was only from his second wife, he remarried as an old man. It was only from his second wife that he had the whole Eger dynasty, the continuation. The Chassam Sofer's daughter, right? You guys know the story? They wanted to set him up. Rabbi Kiva Eger said, the Chassam Sofer is such a giant, he won't let me marry his daughter. The Chassam Sofer said, Rabbi Kiva Eger is such a giant, he won't want to marry my daughter, I'm a simple Jew. Each one said, I'm a simple Jew compared to him. So someone said, let the two simple Jews meet and everything will work out. And they did. And Rabbi Kiva Eger ended up marrying his daughter. The Chafetz Chaim also, his first wife passed away when he was an old man. he was thinking not to remarry, and his kid said, "No, Dad, you got to remarry. Who knows how many years you have left to live?" He ended up living decades with his second wife. He didn't think he had that many years to live. He lived almost 100. The Chafetz Chaim lived a very, very long life. And he, at the end of his life, he thanked his kids. He said some of his most beautiful years were with his second wife. Chazal tell us, if you could, you marry a wife that could have kids, even if you're an older man, so long as you two could connect. You know, you don't want a girl that wants to go out. She wants to go jogging and running and hiking, and you're sitting there with your cane, and it's not a good idea. There has to be, you know, an age gap that's workable. But Chazal do say that a person should try to bring children to the world, even as an older person. You never know which one's going to succeed. So that's what Avram does. And Avram, before he dies, he ensures that there won't be any arguments. He takes the kids he had from his last wife, and he gives them gifts, and he sends them off. And he takes Yitzchak, and he gives him the continuation of Avram's home, and he gives him all the major inheritance. There's a discussion among the commentaries whether Yitzchak was a good businessman or a bad businessman. It's unclear whether Yitzchak maintained Avram's wealth or lost it all. But Yitzchak will learn about in next week's parsha. When it comes time to bury Avram, so Yitzchak and Yishmael bury him. From the fact that Yitzchak is given precedence, we derive that Yishmael did teshuvah. He told Yitzchak, "You're first, you're a righteous Jew, you be first in the burial procession." And that's why we find the name Yishmael was used by our sages. When we choose a name, we should choose a name from Avram Avinu onward. Ideally, we should not take a name before Avram Avinu. The person should not call his son Adam or Noah. We take names that are... Oh, really? We had a guy here named... okay. Look, people don't know that. I mean, people name their son Nimrod, who was the first wicked person. But... right. Look, ideally we choose a name from Avram Avinu onward. I apologize to Adam and Noah. But look, you gotta know the halacha. I'm sorry. We had a guy in Machon Meir, his name was Adam Michael, and he went to Mordechai Leo, and he asked him what to do. Mordechai Leo told him, use the name Michael. So one day he switched to Michael. I don't know if you remember him. It was 4 year time. If a person has two names, then he goes by the other name. It's a kosher name. Adam was God's creation, and Noah was a righteous person. But ideally, when we choose from Avram onward, and that's why, and we only choose righteous people. You don't take a name of someone who is infamously bad. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't call someone Cain. I mean, Cain murdered his brother, right? We wouldn't call someone Nimrod, even though people do today. They don't know that. It's a mistake. Yishmael, because he did tshuva, that's why we find a Rabbi Yishmael in the Talmud, because he did tshuva. When it comes time to choosing your children's names, guys, consult with the rabbi. Do me a favor. Guys coming out of Machon Meir, I get to do brisen. I get to hear the names people call their kids. And people sometimes do a disservice to their kids by naming them all kinds of names that really, if they'd consulted the rabbi, I don't think they would do that. So it's worth consulting. At least give him 10 options. He doesn't have to know which name it'll be. But tell him, you know, we're considering A, B, C, and D. And you guys decide, but at least hear him out. Chazal tell us in ancient generations that they had prophecy, they'd name their children after the times. Our generations that don't have prophecy, already says in the time of the Mishnah, we name our children after our forefathers. We name our children after our grandparents, provided that the grandparent was a decent human being. So we have appreciation for that person. That person brought the child to the world. He's a grandparent, a great-grandparent. So we name after them. You don't have to name after uncles. The child is not a descendant of an uncle. You want to, you could. The custom is that we don't name after someone that died young. Unfortunately, we've witnessed numerous times that people name the child after someone who died young, and the child too died young. So this is something which, I mean, has happened often enough. We do not name after someone who died young. Ideally, you should choose names from grandparents or great-grandparents who were righteous people, who were good people. Sfardim will name after someone while he's still alive. Ashkenazim prefer not to.
What's the definition? No. I mean,
ask your local Orthodox rabbi.
Is that old?
Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. I don't know the answer. I'm not avoiding the question. I don't know.
You're local,
right? I'm local. I'll verify. I don't know. I don't know what the age limit is. I don't know. I have to check. Okay, so the parsha concludes with the offsprings of Yishmael, which will lead us into the offsprings of Yitzchak. The focus of the Torah is to tell us about what happened with Yitzchak and Yaakov and how we descended to Egypt. So the Torah takes 8 psukim and quickly sums up Yishmael's lineage. At the end of next week's parsha, or in 2 weeks, 3 weeks parsha, the Torah will take a short 10-15 psukim and sum up Esav. And the Torah maintains its focus to tell us how the Jews got down to Egypt and how we got out of Egypt, the whole story. Bezrat Hashem, we'll pick up next week. We'll do those minute. I wish everyone